And thanks again to everyone that's read that helps open the meeting. I'll take this opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we first started. And I'd like to extend a warm welcome to any visitors that are with us tonight, and a huge welcome to any newcomers that might be in the room this evening with us. We hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. Like I said, we are a speaker meeting, and it falls on me this evening to introduce our speaker. And I have to confess, I don't know much about this individual, other than he's the other side of the world and lives on an island in the middle of an ocean, which is something that I can relate to quietly. I'm aware that he stepped up at quite short notice to do this, because the original speaker that we had scheduled to speak tonight unfortunately had life turn up and was unable to come and join us. But Donnie very kindly agreed to step in, and he's agreed to come and share his experience, strength and hope with us for the next 40 or 45 minutes, however long is comfortable for himself, on his experience, strength and hope, so his journey into and through Narcotics Anonymous. So I'm just going to hand the floor over to Donnie, and welcome. We're really glad that you're with us. Thank you for getting up early in the morning and being here. And the floor is yours, sir, so please share with us.
Yeah. Aloha, family. I'm a grateful recovering addict, and my name is Donnie.
Hello, Donnie.
Hi, Donnie. Welcome. Welcome.
Hi, Donnie.
Yes, thank you. Mahalo for that.
Aloha. Aloha nui.
Yes, aloha nui. Thank you, Steve, for the introduction here, and welcome to everybody that's here. E komo mai, as we say in Hawaii. This is a different format for me than what I'm typically used to. As this last year and a half has unfolded for many of us, virtual meeting platforms have become a new experience. I understand that virtual meetings have taken place for quite a while, but it's definitely something that's new to me. So, and this format in a audio only is definitely much different. But the basic tenets of recovery are the same, and that is that, you know, we share our experience, strength, and hope about how we do this, how we stay clean a day at a time. And that message is for all of us. We talk about the newcomer being the most important person at any meeting. And so if there is anybody new that's here, please listen to the message as much as you can. And if you don't identify, if there's something that you don't identify specifically with about my particular story, that's not a bad thing. Just remember that that if you come around long enough, you'll eventually hear your story or something very similar to it. And I was told that in my very early recovery, that if I kept showing up here, my life would get better, and that I might identify with people. I might hear things that I identify with. And that's definitely been my experience. I grew up in a small beach community in the west side of Los Angeles. And both of my parents were addicts. I didn't have a horrendously horrific childhood, but there was a lot of violence that went on. You know, my father was, like I said, my father was an addict. And he was a really angry individual. And so, you know, I never knew who was going to show up when my dad came home. I didn't see him often. He owned his own business. And so he was away a lot. When I got up in the morning to go to school, he was still asleep. When I came home in the afternoon, he was at work. And until the late evening hours. And so I didn't really see him a lot, but his presence was definitely very impactful on my life. And so my mom was young when I was born. My mom was 19 when I was born, and she tried to keep it together. You know, I have two younger sisters, and we all, in one form or another, have this disease. And so it wasn't out of normal for me to, you know, to experience people using around me. I have a relatively large Italian family. And so in family gatherings, everybody was drinking, having a great time, or what seemed to be a great time, until at some point there was some fights that broke out. And then the events that had occurred became kind of clouded by the memories of, you know, of the chaos that occurred. And so, you know, I just didn't quite feel like I fit in. I'm left-handed, which for me, growing up in a world of people that that are generally a little different in the way that they do things, I automatically felt like I didn't belong. I remember going to play baseball with some of the neighborhood kids and not knowing how to do it and wanting to try and emulate like the other kids that I saw doing it. And one of the parents noticed that I was throwing the ball with my left hand, but I was batting like all the other kids. And he said, "You're doing it wrong. You're supposed to do it this way." And so it just reinforced those feelings that I didn't fit in. And at some point around the age of 10 or 11, you know, I picked up for the first time. I had a really good friend who had older brothers and sisters, and they all used. And so, you know, I smoked the marijuana for the first time, like I said, about 11 years old, maybe. And I just wanted to feel like I fit in and like I belonged. And so I got to hang out with people that were older than me. And I felt like I fit in. I felt like I kind of had arrived. You know, these people didn't judge me. They, you know, they just accepted me. And so from, you know, from that age until the age of 25, I did what we do. You know, I did what I needed to do to stay loaded. I tried to drop out of school. And at the age of 16, my father kicked me out. He and my mom had split up, and he kicked me out of the house, and I ended up leaving and staying with some family members. And I tried to drop out of school, and by the encouragement of my aunt, you know, I finished. But it kind of set that pattern up that, you know, that I just kind of gave up on things. And so for the next 9 years, you know, I just continued to do, like I said, you know, what we do. You know, I was arrested several times, and I just would get up each day not knowing what was going to happen, but knowing that I couldn't go far from where I was in order for me to stay okay to get through the day. And, you know, through a turn of events, I had met this woman at the beach on our 4th of July celebration. And, you know, I pursued this woman, and I had asked her to marry me. And, you know, as what I've heard described in these rooms as the good addict that I was, you know, I figured that she would make everything better. It would be different somehow. Maybe I could, you know, keep my shit together and become a productive member of society, you know. You know, throughout my using, I was able to maintain employment. So I had the appearance that everything was okay. As long as I kept a job, it seemed to be okay. You know, but the cars that I drove were on the brink of breaking down. You know, I didn't have insurance. You know, like I said, I was just barely struggling through life. And the information that I had got from my parents was that that was normal. You know, you just struggled through the day, and life was difficult. That is really what I got growing up, was that life was difficult. I remember the conversations. I do remember my father saying things, you know, that that portrayed this picture of life just being this terrible event. And so I stayed loaded so that I could block that out. And it did a pretty good job, you know, did a pretty good job of me keeping those feelings completely blocked away, because there were times when, you know, getting towards the end, when, you know, I couldn't imagine not using, but wanting so desperately to stop. And I remember sitting on the floor of this little apartment I had right above the beach, and with a gun at my head, thinking that this was the only solution. You know, the only way that I knew was to kill myself, because it had just gotten so painful. And, you know, and I felt like I had just let everyone down, you know, my family, this woman that I had asked to marry me. It had just gotten so painful that I just felt like maybe that this was the best thing for me to do. And, but at the same time, you know, I was just too afraid. I was too afraid of that unknown consequence of what would happen. Where do I go? You know, what am I going to leave behind? And so gratefully today, you know, I get to look back on that, and I'm grateful that I never mustered up the courage to actually pull the trigger. So, you know, through this experience with this woman, on May 19th of 1988, was an extremely blistering hot day, in this beach community, Santa Monica, that I grew up in. And I was on a mission to find a way to cool down. And, one of my colleagues from work and I, he and I broke into his mom's house looking for a portable air conditioning unit, or at least a fan. And instead, you know, we found some drugs, and we proceeded to get loaded. And then, you know, I remembered being on the beach about a mile or two from my home, and in the pitch black, somehow, I wandered out onto the beach, and the beach there is probably, I don't know, several hundred yards deep, you know, several hundred meters from the road out to the shore. And I passed out on the sand on this beach, and this woman found me somehow. I don't know, because like I said, there's no lights. It was completely pitch black, and several miles from my home, she found me and she brought me home. And in the morning the next day, which was May the 20th, she said, you know, you need to do something or I'm leaving. And that was the start of my journey into recovery. You know, like I said, I had been arrested several times when I was younger, and I had been exposed to 12-step programs, but I didn't think that I had a problem. You know, it was you guys, it was everybody else. If people would just get out of my way and just leave me alone, then, you know, I would be okay. And that was the information that I had received from my parents growing up, was that if people just left you alone and let you do what you wanted to do, then everything would be all right. And so that early exposure to recovery kind of came in that same form. You know, my experience with it was, if people just left me alone, I would be okay. So when I got here in 1988, things were a little different. You know, I finally had family members that were telling me that, you know, maybe I needed to look at the behaviors that I was, you know, that I was exhibiting. And And so I reached out. I was in the Carpenters Union at the time, and I reached out to the union to see if there was some kind of a treatment program that I could go to for a couple of days to figure out my problem here and just trying to kind of get it together. Back in the 80s in the U.S., they were running 30-day treatment programs to just kind of spin dry you and get you back up on your feet and then kick you out the door. And there wasn't anything available for me through the insurance that I had. And so I reached out to a family member, to a cousin who had actually gotten clean about a year before. And I used to use with this person, so I know that they understood. You know, they were pretty much just like me. And they said, you know what, I'll get you to a meeting. And so my cousin came and picked me up and took me to a meeting, and I don't really remember anything about it. But it was the beginning of this journey that has literally saved my life. So I went to this meeting and I did this in hope that I would be showing this woman that I cared about her and that I could get my life together and that I could make it, make it good. And so, I went to a couple of meetings and then I stopped going. And so for the next year and a half, I just stayed abstinent. I didn't pick up. But nothing else changed. I was still this angry, violent person that I had learned to be growing up in that household with my father. And as a result of me not changing anything about me other than not using, that relationship ended. She finally told me, look, you know what, I've had enough. You need to go. And we had come to Hawaii for our honeymoon. And that cousin that took me to my first meeting had a twin brother who was living here in Hawaii. And at the end of my using, I would assume his identity. I would take his car. I would live in his house. I would wear his clothes. And I wanted to be like him. I wanted to be exactly like him. And at the time, he was running drugs between Los Angeles and Hawaii. And I wanted to do what he did. And so when I came to Hawaii and he was here, when I came here for that honeymoon, I hooked up with him. I met with him and he was living on the beach, literally. He had a beat up old car and he was sleeping on the sand. And I thought, that's what I want to do. And so when this woman told me, you know what, I can't do this anymore, I came back to Hawaii, and by this time, I had realized that I needed to make some changes, and this cousin had actually gotten clean as well, and so I started to go to meetings. I would show up, and as terrifying as it was, I started to listen. I started to identify when I heard people talking about wanting to stop using but not knowing how. And some of the other, the other things that I've heard people describe in meetings, I started to really listen. And I started to, for the first time around my disease, I started to take some direction. I got involved and I got into service because I heard people talk about being of service. And so there was I don't remember what day of the week it was, but there was a literature study, a book study meeting. And so I became the person that brought the literature to the meeting. And I had this old beat up car that actually was this cousin's car. And I would, I would need a screwdriver to open the trunk of the car. I needed the screwdriver to turn for the ignition to turn it on. And so that was my key. I just had a screwdriver. And I would keep this box of books in the trunk of this car. And I looked forward when that morning came around, when I got up and I could hear the birds, as you could probably hear in the background right now, I could hear the birds singing, and I looked forward to going to that meeting and bringing the literature, because it meant that I was a part of, because I was the kind of addict that would hide in closets and hide under beds because I didn't want to hear the birds. I didn't want to see people. I didn't want to see the light of day. And so now, when I was waking up, I was enjoying being alive and watching the sunrise come up and hearing the birds and getting to experience this life that I had hid from for so long. And so, I would show up at this meeting with these books and I would feel a part of, in that relationship with that woman, we had a child and I left just before his first birthday. So I was here in Hawaii and not shortly after she called me and said, you need to come get this kid. I can't do this. And so I returned to Los Angeles and I picked up my son who had just turned one at the time. And I became a single father in recovery. I ended up staying back in Los Angeles for a short period, and I started going to meetings there, and I started meeting people, and I got a commitment there, and I started to connect, and I started to get involved. And when I returned to Hawaii, I did what was suggested to me, and that was to get a sponsor and to start working steps. And so, I started going to meetings and I met this man who had one leg and he swore a lot which I thought was kind of cool. But the interesting thing about it is that he was swearing in a meeting and the meeting was in a church. And I thought, wow, okay, so it's okay for me to swear in a church because I have been taught that you don't do that. But being that rebel that I am, I felt like I was in the right place. I finally felt like it was okay, like I had figured out where I was supposed to be. And what I started to notice was that as I drove through, the streets of this little town that I was living in, and I live on an island that's about roughly 600 square miles. And at the time, the population here was only about 40,000 people, which meant that there was a pretty good chance that when I met somebody, I would see them in the community. And so as I would be driving around during the day, I would see people, and I would see people, whether they were in recovery or not, and they would recognize me and they would wave. And so again, I started to feel a part of, I started to feel like I fit in somewhere. Because growing up in Los Angeles with, 10 million people, whatever the population is there, you can get lost. And you might not see somebody ever, you might meet somebody and then not ever see them again. And so, I was starting to feel this sense of belonging. And that was because of what I was feeling in these rooms. But it was starting to spill over into my personal life so that when I saw people in the community, I would wave. And when they waved back, I got this warm feeling that I was significant, that it mattered. It was a completely 180 degree different feeling from sitting on the floor of that apartment with that gun up my head, thinking that the only way out was for me to kill myself, because the pain had gotten so great. And so by this time, the pain was subsiding and I was feeling, pretty good about who I was, so I continued to do this. I just continued to show up at meetings and I continued to work with this man. And he took me through the steps and he taught me a lot. He taught me to get the basic text out and to read and to underline words that I didn't understand and to look them up in a dictionary. and to find out what they meant and to ask questions. And he took me through the steps, and then he took me through the traditions, and he taught me about what it means to be a member of Narcotics Anonymous and what it means to be fully self-supporting through my own contributions. And it wasn't just about money. It was about me giving of my time and any other resource that I had. And that helped to foster that feeling of being a part of, because, you know, I hear people talk about our seventh tradition and that, you know, we make a donation. And it was explained to me that when I donate something is that I'm giving it away and that I don't have any other thoughts about it because it's something that I have that I don't need anymore. But in our literature, it talks about making a contribution. So that I learned that when I make a contribution, I'm vested in it. I have an interest in what I'm doing. And I'm not just giving, but I'm helping to build something. So I started to contribute to this program. And as a result of that, it helped teach me how to contribute to my community and how to contribute to others. And that helped, again, to reinforce that feeling of belonging so that when newcomers came into the meetings, you know, we talk about sharing our experience, strength, and hope. You know, I learned how to do that. I learned how to contribute so that we continue to be an attraction. Because like in those early meetings that I went to, nobody told me that I had to do anything. They just kept welcoming me. You know, we have a saying about let us love you until you can learn to love yourself. And that was important for me, that people just held me and made me feel welcome and loved. And, you know, here in Hawaii, the indigenous culture is very much the same as our, you know, our culture that we have in Narcotics Anonymous, in that, you know, they'd never excluded anyone from the circle. And in NA, it's the same, that we don't exclude people. You know, we have that saying that, you know, everyone is welcome regardless. And so, you know, despite the differences, you know, we welcome each other here. And so when I first came here, there wasn't any local people. There wasn't any local Hawaiian population that was getting clean. And that's different today. You know, today, you know, when I walk into a room, I might be the only person that has white skin and blue eyes. You know, that room might be full of local people. And to me, that's a beautiful thing to see because, you know, I learned when I got here that this disease doesn't discriminate. It doesn't care what I look like. It doesn't care where I came from. It doesn't care how much money I have. It doesn't care whether I'm a man or a woman, if I'm straight or if I'm gay. It just wants me dead, but it will settle for me loaded. So to see people who have a different culture, who don't look like me, who are the indigenous people of this place that I live in, it warmed my heart to see people starting to get clean. Because this disease doesn't discriminate. And much like me, you know, the culture that they live in tries to tell them that they don't need this, that they can handle, that they can figure it out. And that's been my experience, that that no matter where I go, the disease tells us that we can handle. That's been my experience watching other addicts and listening to other addicts share that somehow this disease tells them that they don't need us. And so I'm so grateful for the ability for that message to finally get through, and certainly for it to get through to me, because that, like I said, that was what I thought. I didn't need you guys. I didn't need this. I can figure it out. So, you know, today, you know, I stuck around. Like I said, I arrived here on this island in 1989. I had a little stint that I had to run back to Los Angeles. And then I returned here with that little kid as a single father. And, you know, he's grown up today. He's 32 years old now. And he's married and he has a normal life, or what I could, I guess, best describe as normal. He's definitely not an addict. Certainly not like, you know, certainly not like me. You know, in those early days in recovery here, I met a woman here on this island who, like myself, was an addict. And, you know, still being that addict that I was, you know, I would say things like, I'm not looking for a relationship. And I would keep her at arm's distance. And, you know, I was friends with her boyfriend, and I would go over to their home, on, you know, Saturday or Sunday mornings, and I would make crepes, and, or I would come in the evening and I would make pasta, and we would sit and we would talk and we would hang out. And they broke up, their relationship ended, but I kept showing up at that house. And and this past July, you know, we celebrated 22 years of being married, you know, because I learned how to be a little bit better of a person. And today, you know, we have two sons, together. Our youngest is 17 and the middle one is 21. And that middle one, just graduated from a Mercedes-Benz program in Los Angeles. He actually moved back to the city that I grew up in. And he got a job with the Mercedes-Benz dealership there in Los Angeles. And none of those three boys have ever seen either of us loaded. They learned, because of these rooms, because of our traditions, they learned to be self-supporting through their own contributions. You know, they've learned about, you know, our common welfare, you know, and how our unity is so important and how we stick together. You know, these are things that I may have been exposed to by my parents, but the lessons were never there. You know, that 21-year-old 5 months ago had gone back to Los Angeles to start this program for school. And after a couple of days, he called and he wanted to quit. He wanted to leave. And I reminded him about, you know, some of the things that I've taught him in life about just showing up no matter what, even when you don't want to be there, which is the message that I got from people in these rooms, that when I don't want to go to a meeting, that's probably the time that I should show up. You know, when it feels like quitting is the right thing to do, I should probably do the exact opposite. And that has made the difference in not just my life, but the life of the people around me. You know, I'd like to portray myself as somebody that floats around like a guru and that I've got it all figured out, you know, but the truth is that I'm still an addict, and that, you know, sometimes life is a struggle. You know, 3 years ago, this relationship with this woman that I've been married to for 22 years almost ended because of my disease. Not because I was going to pick up and use, but because I had stopped using the tools. You know, one of the most effective tools that we have is communication. And I stopped talking and I started shutting down. And, you know, today things are different. You know, my life isn't perfect. probably just from my perspective, but as I look around, it's probably as perfect as I could imagine it. I'm sitting outside on a lanai, and I'm looking at my yard, and I have palm trees around me, and I have birds singing, and I have roosters crowing in the background, and there's a slight breeze. And this is not what my life was like when I walked into these rooms. Those last few days were, you know, taking a bus ride into the inner city, and everything around me was gray and dreary, and life just wasn't good. And today, my life is amazing. You know, I own my own business, and, you know, I'm able to support my family, and I have some stuff, you know, like I have some things, I have some material goods. But what I have that's more important than that is that I have some self-respect and some self-esteem. And I've definitely made some really big mistakes, or I've made some poor choices. And as a result of that, you know, when I look for the lesson and the opportunity, you know, I get to learn something. I get to learn to just hopefully not do that again. You know, there's a line in the basic text that talks about, you know, insanity. The definition is that, you know, we do the same things over and over expecting a different result. And then on the next page, it says that insanity is doing the same thing over and over, even when we know what the results are going to be. And so, you know, I've been able to really grasp that and hang on to that and know that I don't have to make the same mistakes over and over, because it really truly is insanity for me. You know, it is an insane thing for me to think that if I just do this, it might be different this time. But I still practice that on occasion. I still think that maybe I can somehow shove that, that, you know, that square peg into that round hole. You know, but if you leave it to an addict, you know, our symbol is exactly that. It is a square peg that is in a round hole. We just got smart enough to make the fucking hole bigger in order to put the peg into. You know, as I sit here and I'm looking up and I see this beautiful blue sky and these puffy white clouds and I see these green trees and stuff all around me, you know, I get overwhelmed. You know, I get overwhelmed with emotion because, like I said, when I showed up here, I really desperately wanted to die. And I couldn't see any way out of the hole that I was in. And, you know, an addict showed up and told me to just drop the shovel because the only thing that I knew was to keep digging. And somebody reached down and gave me a hand and pulled me out of that hole. And so today, when an addict says, I need help, you know, I'm able to be of service. You know, I've been blessed with showing up to a meeting in the UK in April of last year. That for me happened to just be at 9 a.m. in the evening. So it was like I was getting ready for bed anyway. And it became my online home group. And I have service commitment in that meeting that I've actually been doing. I've had some sort of service in that committee since July of last year. And it's through that connection to these rooms and the people in it that I met someone who I've been in service with, who actually reached out this week and said, hey, you know what, I was supposed to share at this meeting, but I, you know, something came up last minute. Are you available? And so, like, when I got here and I put my hand out and people helped me, I learned to do that today. And so I said, absolutely, you know, if it's from Narcotics Anonymous, you know, I'm willing to be of service. And so, you know, because of that, I'm able to get up at you know, the early morning hour here in Hawaii and be in a meeting in the UK in the evening. And that's only through the power of this fellowship, because I don't know, you know, when I was using, if I had gone to sleep Friday night and Saturday morning had come around, I didn't want to be up. I certainly wasn't, like I said, I certainly wasn't looking forward to hearing the birds singing and watching the sunrise. And today I live for that. I have thousands of pictures of sunrises because it's something that I get to do now. You know, I'll finish with this. When I got here, that was the very first lesson that I learned, is that I don't have to do any of this. I get to. I get to pay bills as much as I complain about it and grumble. I get to pay taxes as much as I complain about it. I get to be a father. I get to be a husband. I get to be a productive member of my community. And I don't have to do any of it, because you guys reminded me that you would gladly refund my misery if I didn't think that what I was getting here was better. And my experience has been that it is beyond my wildest dreams better. So I want to thank everybody that is in service this meeting for showing up and being of service and making it possible for myself and other addicts to show up and have a place to feel like we fit in and like we belong. Because I truly believe that I belong here today. So thank you very much. Mahalo to everyone on the committee, and I'll leave it there.